Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm talking to Neil Shah. Neil is steeped in finance with the majority of his career to date having been spent at Stifel Financial, a wealth management and investment bank. After 15 years in the sector, he found the disconnect between the public and private tech ecosystems hugely frustrating. And so since mid-2020, decided to play a part in fixing it, joining the London Stock Exchange Group as senior business development manager as a technology sector specialist. Neil, thank you for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me, Arish.
Not a problem at all. And I must shout out the usual disclaimer. Neil is not a relation, although we may have some sort of common background somewhere down the track. But it would be great to actually understand a little bit more about you, what you've been doing, and your current role at the London Stock Exchange.
Certainly, Arish. So it's really nice to meet you. My name is Neil Shah. I head business development for the tech sector at London Stock Exchange. I live in East London with my wife and two boys, which can be hard at times because I'm a Liverpool fan. I'm surrounded by West Ham and Arsenal fans, but you know, everyone enjoys a challenge. I grew up in Corby, Northamptonshire, and I'm the son of two immigrants, second generation Indian. I went to school at Brooke Weston. That's my first lucky break, where the school is parts funded by the state, but also philanthropists such as the late Garfield Weston and Apple Macintosh, which took me into the tech industry. We had 400 Apple Macs in the school. So I was building PCs, playing around in Macs, building LAN networks as I was growing up. And as you do, decided to start a career in finance. So I went to London School of Economics, interned with Lazard, joined Dresdner Kleinwort's grad program. And my MD at the time saw this tech stuff on my CV and said, come and join my team. So I did that for about 5 years, then moved across to Thomas Weisel Partners, which was a US boutique. We were acquired by Stifel a year later. And I spent about 10 years predominantly working with European tech founders, many of whom were VC-backed, looking at M&A, IPOs in the UK, but also into the States and other jurisdictions. And it was fascinating, Arish, to meet so many people who had built really interesting businesses, and then found that they had a year, sometimes less of a runway before the VCs wanted their capital back and were looking for options. And I guess one of the frustrations that you've touched on is historically there has been this disconnect between public and private. We have a thriving tech sector on the public markets in London. And what I'd like to do is encourage founders to be a little bit more ambitious with their companies and come and talk to us, because London Stock Exchange is open to companies of all sizes. And the role here is hugely exciting. I sit in a team of about 20 people. We've got feet on the ground in most jurisdictions internationally, including the States, the Middle East, India, Africa. And our role is really to provide as much or as little support as companies need to get ready for an IPO. And that includes connecting board members, advisors, providing objective advice on what a London IPO looks like and demystifying that journey. We also help the government implement policy change. So it won't surprise you that we've been heavily involved in both the Khalifa and Hill reviews. And it's hugely exciting to see some of the changes coming through that will make London one of the most founder-friendly exchanges in the world. When I joined London Stock Exchange, I spoke to some of my contacts on the buy side, including fund managers like Guy Feld, who basically told me to go and find them some deals. And it's been great to see some of those deals coming through into the market. We had 8 tech and consumer internet IPOs last year, and we've had 30 in the year so far, and hopefully a few more before the end of the year.
That's amazing. And I understand those metrics are the busiest kind of IPO season in tech and venture since 2000. So it's pretty impressive. I think you kind of touched on it, and I'd like to explore this a bit further, right? Because a lot of ventures look at exit by acquisition as being the easiest, maybe, or the most lucrative, I don't know, kind of method of exiting. Maybe they are kind of spooked by considering IPO, but it'd be great to understand why it is important, in your opinion, to have a strong public market as part of the overall tech ecosystem, because it is something that we don't talk about a huge amount when you're operating in tech and venture, right? It's the other side of tech and venture. I mean, obviously, a lot of us are waiting to get that big, but equally, it's not talked about until right the end. Why is it so important?
Sure, Arish, great question. Perhaps we can start with, you know, why look at an IPO in the first place? I fundamentally believe that it's easier to build businesses for an IPO than it is for sale. And it's great and reassuring to hear people like Reid Hoffman of PayPal and LinkedIn fame, you know, say the same thing, that, you know, I've met so many founders that, you know, want to sell their businesses to Apple or Microsoft or IBM. But the truth is, you never really know what those strategic buyers are looking for at a specific moment in time and whether your company is going to be able to fit in and, you know, what they're doing internally. Whereas an IPO is just a natural extension of what you're doing already, getting access to evergreen capital. This is why we've seen venture firms even list on our market, like Draper Esprit, Augmentum, Forward Partners. That's the first point. Secondly, it doesn't cost a lot to evaluate an IPO. So the real litmus test is going to see investors and getting an understanding if they're willing to back you. No dissimilar to doing a venture round. And you can get a quick answer before you really spend any costs. It gives companies and founders independence. The IPO is access to that initial capital, but also follow-on capital. Companies like ASOS have come back to market about 9 times since they've been on our market. And you can do that in a matter of weeks. It's one of the beauties of being a public company. Everyone's in ordinary shares. There's no liquidation preferences to worry about. There's not one master that you report into. You don't have people sitting on your board. Public company investors tend to be passive versus active investors. And at the end of the day, you get to create wealth for you and the entire team through this vehicle. So definitely worth exploring. I think it's really important to have a strong local stock exchange. First reason is why not, right? It's about self-reliance and independence. And I take a lot of pride in what we built at London Stock Exchange. We've got some of the best universities in the world, some fantastic unicorns. It's only right and fitting that we have a stock market to match. And hopefully you're seeing this with the momentum that we've touched on. And I guess the more companies that list here, the more ownership that these companies can have from local investors, from local pensioners, the better the stock exchange does, and hopefully the better the UK economy does as well. We're fortunate to have an exchange that works, right? We've had 85 IPOs in the year to date. 30 of those have been in tech and consumer internet. And speaking to advisors, bankers, lawyers, accountants, everyone's busy building out a pipeline for the next 4 to 5 years. And we've produced more unicorns than any other country, bar the US and China. And it's also interesting to see that we've had more IPOs than any other country, bar the US and China this year. The UK is a really deep market where companies can access investors from all around the world. You can achieve strong valuations here and achieve many of the benefits that I'll come on to. IPOs are, you know, a natural option for many. And, you know, going public in your home market is also the natural option, right? Because companies know who THG are or May.com are, as an example, or Victorian Plumbing. So, you know, why go to a foreign jurisdiction where you're not known by customers, investors, etc.? I think it's important to have choice. Competition is great. We welcome what other exchanges are doing, the fact that the M&A market's hot, because at the end of the day, we want companies and founders to achieve the right answer for their business. And that's just healthy for everyone. And lastly, I would say that historically, we've seen there's a perception that many UK tech companies go to the States. In reality, we've probably seen about 3 or 4 head over in the last 3 years. And our biggest source of competition is companies selling too early, I think, and getting acquired. I think there's so much more to be gained, and the potential for founders to have 2 bites of the cherry by taking the companies public, raising further capital, doing acquisitions, growing their companies into a bigger business, and then achieving that exit down the line. And just coming back to the point, we'd love to see founders being more ambitious.
That makes a huge amount of sense. And you've touched on it a couple of times. I'd like to dig into that in a bit more detail, right? So why are companies choosing to list in the UK? And really, why should they, right? What's the perception of the US that leads the UK to lose deals? And we had a question that came up on Twitter actually yesterday, which was, well, if you're a UK-based venture, which maybe has equal kind of footing in the US and the UK, or maybe even has subsidiaries in both jurisdictions, why choose the UK over the US? What is it about, you know, the perception? Is it just that kind of ringing the bell out on Wall Street is what's attractive? Is it that, or is it something else? What do you think?
Arash, as you all know, everything's bigger in the States, and I've met a few entrepreneurs who don't dream of going down Sandhill Road and hanging out in Silicon Valley. But what I say to them is that you can achieve so many of the benefits of a US listing in London without many of the costs. And I think this point on valuation is a bit of an urban myth. You know, when you dig in to European company valuations, you look at where Adyen's trading or Delivery Hero or Avast on our home market, and you compare them to their local peers and international peers, you see that often the company with the better fundamentals, and typically that's growth, right, achieves the highest valuation. It's not really to do with listing venue or even the scale of the company. It's really the quality of the company and the TAM that they're going after. So that's the first point. It's great to see founders being more objective when you are surrounded by guys and girls whose only experience has been US IPOs. It can be a bit of an echo chamber. And this is what we're trying to solve for here at London Stock Exchange, is to provide the whole board with not only the advice, but also the network, so they can make an objective decision and determine what's right for their companies. I think it's a natural point in the cycle now that we've had companies staying private for longer. They are exploring exits, and it's great that they can do that on London Stock Exchange. And for some, sure, it's going to be an exit, it provides liquidity. But for the CEO, really, this is a new beginning and a continuation of what they're doing. It allows them to stay independent, access capital in weeks. You can do an IPO on our AIM market in 10 and a half weeks. You can raise follow-on capital from start to finish in about 2.5 weeks, which I think is absolutely phenomenal. And I think the reason you can do that is the regulatory framework we have in place, the processes that we put in over years. AIM is now 25 years old, but also the fact that most advisors are within walking distance, investors are around the corner. It's great to have Zoom and Teams, but it's also great to be able to go and have a coffee and see people, which you can certainly do in our city.
So a couple of kind of interesting points that have come out of everything you've just discussed. So the first is, as you were talking, I think given the number of tech IPOs that have happened in the UK, to date, you're saying, 30 this year, but that's the best performance over the last 20 years. And we only had 8 sort of consumer and tech IPOs in 2020. I work with lots of CFOs. I'm a CFO myself. The reality is that I probably could count on the fingers of one hand the number of CFOs that I personally know that have listed, taken a venture onto the markets here in the UK. And, even then, probably fewer still that have maybe listed in the US and then come back over to the UK. So it'd be interesting to understand from you if you think that plays a part, right? So if that mechanism or that kind of relationship driven model where, the CFO is on the roadshow of the CEO and they're just much more comfortable in the US because that's where they've done it in the past. It'd be interesting to understand if you think that's played a factor or been a factor. And the second question really is, you mentioned that ventures are staying private longer and that's being borne out absolutely in the data. And, do you think therefore that the recent kind of trend we've seen for secondary listings versus primary listings is maybe also, playing a factor in bolstering that appetite for listing here in the UK, where we've had a couple of successful secondary listings, which obviously allows founders to create liquidity for themselves, for their employees, but don't have to go out and secure fresh capital on the markets?
Great questions, Arash. So we spoke about the disconnect between public and private, and what you started off with is exactly that. We've got 216 companies with a primary listing or quote in London in the tech and consumer internet sectors, and hundreds of CFOs that I'd love to connect your network with, because I think if we're going to build more public tech companies and build that $100 billion business in London, it's going to be us helping each other and we versus I. The good news is that everyone I speak to on the public side want to get to know private companies, to advise them, to get onto their boards, to help them grow. I've had no shortage of inquiries. And we're starting to see this now that because of the momentum we've had and peers going public, there is this peer pressure for others to explore a public listing. IPOs come in waves, right? You have hot markets and markets where the equity window isn't as open and it's harder. And typically you see the larger companies coming to market. And what we're seeing right now is that an opening of the IPO cycle and more companies coming to list, more venture-backed businesses the valuation support going public. I mean, that's the fundamental driver, right? That if you're getting a higher price privately, why would you even consider an IPO? But the fact that public valuations now tend to lead is really helpful. So that's definitely opening up dialogues. And I think the fact that take TA Associates, they listed ATG early in the year and now are coming back with Euroag because ATG has performed tremendously well. I'm sure that impacted their thinking. The market is disconcerting about primary and secondary. Fundamentally, fund managers just want to see good deals. And if you can justify the level of secondary in that transaction and get them comfortable, that's more than enough. Ultimately, this is a people game and it's about building trust. And I think the biggest barrier is fund managers, new investors, not really knowing some of these startups. And so we encourage startups and fund managers telling us this, come and see us 2-3 years ahead of your IPO, get to know the community, the analysts who are going to be the voice of the market, position your story right. And we can help you get this done because ultimately we want to invest in your IPOs.
Thanks. I think that's really important and 100% getting closer to that end of the market. And I think, we were talking about it earlier. One of the reasons I really was excited to have you on this podcast is because we spend a lot of time talking about venture and VC funding and potentially private equity and exits to, to acquirers. But it's really refreshing to actually talk about the grown-up end of the market, which is ultimately where we should all be looking to kind of head. And I'd really love to understand from your perspective, since you've joined or over the last couple of years, what are the kind of really standout listings that you're really pleased about? And what are some that you wished had maybe chosen the UK but didn't over the last couple of years?
Sure, Arash. So we've got to love all our children equally. And I'm pleased to say that we generally do. It's great to see so many fantastic companies coming through, large and small. Just looking at the range of companies, we had ATG early in the year. This was a £50 million revenue business, acquiring a business in the US. They were growing about 12%. I think the business they acquired are growing 43%. It's happened to be a profitable business as well. The bar is quite low and lower than most people would imagine to get onto our market. You take Buddy with about £30 million of revenue. Again, not a huge company by many people's standards, but growing 54%, EBITDA margin of 53%. Being profitable isn't a prerequisite to listing in London. We see many companies that aren't profitable, but as long as you can justify the burn with outsized growth, investors can get comfortable. We've seen that on a number of IPOs this year. I think it was great to see Coof in September 2020. That really opened the market for me. That was a company with sub £10 million of revenue and growing at a healthy clip, about 60, £70 million of market cap. It's great to see some big deals come through. THG, which was the largest UK internet IPO on record at the time, raised about £900 million of primary and a similar level of secondary. To your point on secondaries, just shows what you can do in London. There's ample capital available. Great to see Wise, a direct listing. You can do these things in London. We altered our auction mechanism to facilitate that transaction. And I think for those companies that are lucky like Wise and not needing to access primary capital, have provided liquidity to shareholders along the way, have a brand following that would lend itself to natural liquidity, a direct listing is another great route that companies can use to go public. You don't have to use the IPO, the traditional IPO route. But what I'd say on the traditional IPO route is that it works wonderfully. And we've seen that if you look at the stats for the last 30 tech and consumer internet IPOs, they go up about 11% on day one, right? And you contrast that to other markets where we've seen so many stocks double. There's something fundamentally wrong there. I think the difference in the UK and Europe generally is this early look process that you can go and meet investors 2, 3, 4 times ahead of an IPO. They understand the story. If it happens to be a hot deal, you can change the structure of that transaction, raise more capital. Typically, we find that companies will know, how much primary they want to raise, but there'll be a question mark over how much secondary they may be able to place in those hotter deals. You tend to find that that secondary component gets increased. And sometimes price gets increased as well. But ultimately, it's got to be a win-win, right? That those new investors coming into the cap structure need to make money as well. And so you want to make sure that the price is right and you're setting yourself up for the future. The IPO ought to be the cheapest price at which you'll then raise equity.
That's super interesting, Neil. I mean, again, as you're, you know, talking about different structures, it would be remiss of me not to mention SPACs in this conversation. What is the position in London and the UK around SPACs? Are we seeing those sort of listings? And for our listeners, a SPAC is effectively a reverse merger where an existing shell company is listed and then has a mandate to go out and acquire a business which it folds into. And it just reduces the time, you know, for the acquired business to get onto the exchange. Is that something that we're seeing a lot of here in the UK?
Yeah, Irish advisors are, you know, exploring SPACs really on the back of the rapid response by the FCA to the Lord Hill recommendations. So Lord Hill kicked off the Hill review in November last year. There were calls for evidence in January. The review was published in March. Rishi Sunak issued a response in April. The FCA started a consultation in April as well, which concluded in July and in August. There was a rule change to allow effectively US-style SPACs in London. And as a result of that, I think that some sponsors that, you know, wanted to launch SPACs that were looking at other European markets will certainly consider a London. Now, it will come as no surprise to anyone listening to this podcast that the heat in the SPAC market has come out. You always see this with new mechanisms. There's always a bit of a bubble at the start, but I think that's healthy for the market because hopefully it means that better SPACs and better companies will come forward, and we'll see, you know, SPACs launched by like Klaus Hommel's coming forward versus some of these celebrity SPACs that we've seen in other markets and people rolling trucks down hills. It's great to see a bit greater regulatory scrutiny on these things. But again, I think for founders, it's just more choice, right? Ultimately, I mean, there's so many advantages of being a public company. We at London Stock Exchange don't care if these companies come through the traditional IPO route, for a direct listing, for a SPAC, through a demerger, as long as they go public. I think that's great. And one other point just to highlight is, you know, all the companies that go public here create thousands of jobs. You take Deliveroo, they've created about 50,000 jobs. And, you know, that's really helpful for different parts of the UK. It's not just about London. You take Manchester, where we've had In the Style, Virgin Wines, Victorian Plumbing, Music Magpie, and so many more companies listing in the local area. That clearly helps the local ecosystem. Obviously, THG is there as well, and many of their hundreds of staff receive shares, which is great. But it also means that the advisory community gets lifted up as well. Not only the bankers, but the accountants, the lawyers, financial PR firms, registrar, so many others. That benefits local society as well. And I think that's really important. We're seeing that in Scotland. We're seeing that in the Midlands. We're seeing that in the southwest of the UK. And that's reflective of where we see startups being created. Again, it's not just about London, which is fantastic. And we're also seeing more and more international companies look at London.
Yeah, I think rising tide lifting all ships is a great way to look at it. And I agree, it creates not just liquidity, but to your point, just ripple effects throughout the economy. And I think that's actually a really interesting point to just touch on. I mean, you know, diversity is a hot topic within tech and venture, whether that's sort of at the LP level, the VC level, or even kind of the operating company level. How do you see that at the London Stock Exchange in terms of companies that are coming out and IPOing? What's your take on that?
I think in a true British understated fashion, it's not spoken about enough, but we have made strides in the time that I've been in the city, Arish. And I look at the boards of many of the companies that have come to market to see the level of diversity. It's really heartwarming. You look at Kate Swan and Susan Hooper at Moonpig, where Nicole's the CEO. Fantastic. You know, same for Trustpilot's board, where you've got Angela and Claire on their board, Claudia, chairwoman at Deliveroo. We've got, you know, so many female board members and execs, and Maytech was no exception, that joined our market at the end of September. We've had three female tech CEOs come to market: Romy Savova at PensionBee, Poppy Gustafsson at Darktrace, and of course, Sarah Murray, who's third-time entrepreneur at Big Technologies, otherwise known as Buddy. We see that at the CFO level as well, at Darktrace with Catherine Graham, at Dynomi with Charlotte there, Debbie Lovegrove at Maytech, you know, so many other companies like Northcoders. And again, minorities, Will Shu, Mahmood Attar at ITIM, Nadim at Microlize. We've touched on Moonpig, Gordon at Oxford Nanopore, which is a fantastic win for London. And great to see a company that's not going to be profitable for a few years coming through with investors appreciating, you know, the commitment to deep tech and life sciences. And I think something that's perhaps not highlighted is if you look at, you know, the listed universe of companies, we also see female CEOs like Joanna Arnold or minorities, you know, sometimes as teams, Milan Patel and Paragamin at Dodd Digital as a good example. So it's great to see this. I think that this creates role models, and that's, you know, all we need, so that, you know, budding entrepreneurs realize that, you know, they can take their companies public too. And I think I'm a big fan of Matthew Syed. He's written a lot about cognitive diversity. I think you only get that from having not only diversity in terms of gender and sexuality and ethnicity, but also in, you know, the backgrounds of some of these founders. I mean, not everyone went to Eton. You know, so many have built businesses on the back of redundancy checks. And yeah, I think it's uplifting that you can take small businesses public on our market. I think, you know, venture and private equity do a fantastic job. But for some companies, you can go public earlier. There's no right or wrong answer here. We're here to help you assess what's right for your individual companies.
I think that's hugely aspirational. I'd agree. The more kind of role models, as you put it, that are in the ecosystem, the more I think attractive it becomes for people who would otherwise maybe have thought that, you know, it wasn't for them, or they couldn't do it, or, you know, there's no one like me out there. I think I'd like to just kind of round off the conversation, Neil, with just, you know, a quick thought from you on, you know, the future of IPOs and tech in London and the UK. What is your kind of, you know, 1 to 3 year horizon? What do you see, and what are you excited about?
Arash, I'm really excited about everything that is going on in the tech sector right now. The number of companies that we're building, the number of unicorns that get reported each week. I think Tech Nation and Innovate Finance and so many industry bodies are doing a fantastic job. It's great to see the government from Number 10, the Treasury, DCMS, DIT, Bays, you know, all really behind the sector and encouraging entrepreneurs to go and start companies. They realize that this is the only way we're going to create, you know, more jobs in the UK. And it'll be great to see this continue in floats. The pipeline is looking strong. I think we're at a level which looks sustainable for the foreseeable future. And ultimately, I think as long as interest rates remain low and investors are looking for yield, you're going to find that in equities. So I am long equities for the medium to long term, and it'd be great to see more companies. Ultimately, this is your stock exchange, right? This is what we make of it. So I encourage founders from the UK, from the overseas jurisdictions to definitely look at London and the benefits that it provides.
Amazing. Neil, I would like to thank you so much for having joined me today. It's been a really incredible conversation. Where can our listeners find you? Are you on LinkedIn or Twitter? What's the best place to look for you and anything that they want to know about the London Stock Exchange?
Sure, Arash. We'll drop the details into the show notes, but my email is neil, neil.shah@lseg.com, Neil Shah UK on LinkedIn, Twitter. I'd love to speak and help as many of you as I can, as with the team here. So don't hesitate to reach out to any of us. We've also got a fantastic website with a lot of written content and case studies, videos, more podcasts, less of me and more from founders who've been there, done it. I can tell you the good, the bad, the ugly about life as a public company, but I hope that resonates with you. And we've got some fantastic events throughout the year. Our flagship IPO forum, where you can hear from some of the fantastic advisors. Ultimately, I encourage companies and founders and boards to go and talk to as many people as they can. We've got so many fantastic analysts in London that know the sector broadly. You know, tech comes in waves. Sometimes hardware is hot, sometimes software is hot, sometimes services is hot. There is some convergence. The beauty about London analysts is that they're not knee deep in cybersecurity. They understand how all these companies work and the interplay between them. And I think that's going to become even more important going forward. They also know how to read balance sheets. And I definitely like to connect you with some of my wonderful friends in the analyst community and investors. So reach out if we can help.
Excellent. Thank you, Neil. Really appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?